This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Pro Savings Days are on at Lowe's. Get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, my Lowe's Pro Rewards members get an additional 5% off when you buy 5 or more select GE, Whirlpool, and Electrolux kitchen or laundry major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 123. Discount valid to my Lowe's Pro Rewards members only. Exclusions and other restrictions apply. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See associate or Lowe's.com for details. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Imagine a master conductor within your body, silently orchestrating everything from how you grow to how you handle stress, even, you know, your ability to stay perfectly hydrated. Now, what happens when that incredibly delicate system, the endocrine system, goes a little, well, off kilter? The effects aren't just profound, they cascade, impacting the entire human system in surprising and often critical ways. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into that fascinating, really intricate world of endocrine disorders and, maybe more importantly, their critical management. This isn't just abstract biology. It's about what happens right there on the front lines of patient care, particularly for those of you stepping into the demanding but incredibly rewarding field of nursing. Our deep dive today is based on a pretty comprehensive set of notes, a roadmap, if you will, covering the assessment and management of patients with endocrine disorders. We're talking about everything from the fundamental functions of this powerful system to specific high-stakes conditions like diabetes insipidus, SIDH, Cushing's syndrome, Addison's disease, and those acute diabetic emergencies that demand immediate action, DKA and HHS. So our mission today is crystal clear. We want to extract the most important insights, the practical knowledge, and those crucial aha moments from all this material. Our goal is really to equip you with a shortcut to being not just well-informed, but truly confident in understanding these complex patient scenarios. We're focusing on what truly matters in your nursing practice, empowering you to protect patients, interpret vital clinical changes, and coordinate care like a seasoned pro. Okay, let's unpack this. Before we dive into the specific disorders that can, you know, throw our bodies out of balance, I think it's essential we grasp what the endocrine system actually does. It's so much more than just a collection of glands, isn't it? It really feels like the body's grand orchestrator.
It absolutely is. It's a great way to put it. What's truly fascinating here is its vital overarching role in orchestrating this vast array of cellular interactions throughout the body. Think of it as the body's highly sophisticated internal communication network. It uses chemical messengers, which we call hormones, to constantly transmit messages. It meticulously regulates metabolism, influences growth from infancy right through adulthood, governs reproduction, plays a significant part in the aging process, and critically, mediates our body's entire response to adverse conditions like stress or illness. It's managing processes at every level, you know, from the microscopic cellular level all the way up to systemic responses, making sure everything is synchronized.
That makes so much sense, picturing it as this dynamic communication network. But with so many hormones and so many functions, how does it keep everything in such precise balance? I remember reading about something called a negative feedback mechanism that sounds like it might be the key to its stability.
You're honing in on one of its most foundational principles.
Yeah.
The negative feedback mechanism is essentially how the body achieves and maintains homeostasis, that perfect internal equilibrium. Imagine it like a thermostat in your house. When the levels of a particular hormone in the bloodstream rise above a set point, kind of like the ideal temperature, the endocrine system senses this increase. In response, it signals the gland responsible for producing that hormone to slow down or even halt its production.
Okay.
Conversely, if hormone levels drop too low, the system prompts increased production to bring them back up to the optimal range. It's a beautifully efficient, self-regulating loop that prevents both overproduction and underproduction. And when this delicate, self-correcting feedback loop fails or becomes dysfunctional, well, that's precisely when we often see endocrine disorders emerge, leading to either an excess or a deficiency of crucial hormones. And that throws the entire system off kilter.
Right. So these chemical messengers are all hormones the same. The notes mention amines, peptides, steroids, and fatty acid derivatives. That sounds like a lot of different types. And I'm wondering if, you know, understanding these distinctions truly matters for a nurse on the floor.
Oh, that's an excellent question, because their structure dictates their mechanism of action. And that absolutely has direct implications for nursing practice.
Yeah.
We have several key types, and understanding these categories is quite insightful for how you approach patient care. First, we have amines and amino acids. These are generally simpler structures, often derived from amino acids like tyrosine. Familiar hormones like epinephrine and norepinephrine, our classic fight-or-flight hormones, fall into this category. They tend to act relatively quickly. Then there are peptides, polypeptides, proteins, and glycoproteins. These are larger, more complex molecules. And here's a core insight for you. What's crucial to remember about this group is that they typically act on the cell surface. They bind to receptors located on the outer membrane of target cells. Because of their size and chemical nature, they generally can't pass through the cell membrane directly to act inside the cell. Instead, their binding to the surface receptor triggers a cascade of events within the cell, leading to the desired physiological response. Insulin is a prime example of a peptide hormone.
Makes sense.
Now, in stark contrast, we have steroids. These hormones, like cortisol or estrogen, are lipid-soluble. This unique characteristic is a real game changer. It allows them to easily pass directly through the lipid bilayer of the cell membrane.
Right through.
Exactly. Once inside the cell, they often bind to intracellular receptors. And these hormone receptor complexes then travel to the nucleus, directly influencing gene expression and protein synthesis. This means their effects can be slower to manifest, but often more profound and long-lasting compared to peptide hormones. Think about how long it takes for, say, a steroid pack to really kick in compared to an insulin injection.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Finally, there are fatty acid derivatives, another class with specific localized signaling roles, things like prostaglandins, which often act on nearby cells. So connecting this back to your question about nursing relevance, when a patient is prescribed a hormone, knowing its type, like if it's a fast-acting peptide or a slower intracellular steroid, it changes everything about your nursing expectation. You won't be wondering why an IV insulin dose, a peptide, isn't causing immediate cellular changes the way a cortisol pill, a steroid, does, because you understand their fundamental difference in action. This helps you anticipate onset, peak, and duration, timing your assessments and interventions with precision. It's not just a biology fact, it's a guide for your clinical judgment.
That's a fantastic distinction to keep in mind, especially when you're managing medications and observing patient responses. Given this incredible complexity and the widespread effects of hormones, how do nurses really approach a patient with a suspected endocrine issue? The notes lay out the nursing process for endocrine disorders, which seems like a very systematic way to tackle something so broad and, well, often nebulous.
You're right. The nursing process isn't just some theoretical model you learn in a textbook. It's a dynamic, systematic roadmap. It's absolutely essential for effective and safe patient care, especially with the intricate and often subtle nature of endocrine disorders. It really empowers you to provide truly holistic and responsive care. It all begins with assessment. This is paramount. You need to gather a thorough health history, asking detailed questions about family history, medication use, especially over-the-counter stuff, or herbal remedies, recent illnesses, and even subtle, seemingly unrelated changes in energy levels, mood, sleep patterns, or body weight that might, you know, unbeknownst to the patient, indicate a hormonal imbalance. This is followed by a general physical assessment and then a system-specific assessment, meticulously looking for those often subtle cues, things like changes in skin texture, hair growth, distribution of body fat, or even subtle tremors. A classic example. Maybe new onset of unexplained weight gain coupled with fatigue might prompt you to consider thyroid issues during your assessment. Next are diagnostic evaluations. As a nurse, your role isn't just to administer tests, but to understand why they're ordered and what their results mean. For endocrine disorders, this could mean specific hormone levels, glucose tolerance tests, or even more complex stimulation or suppression tests. You're not just reading a number, you're interpreting its significance in the context of the patient's overall presentation. For instance, knowing that a low TSH level with a high thyroid hormone level points to hyperthyroidism or vice versa changes your entire approach to care planning.
Okay, that makes sense.
From there, we move to diagnosis. This involves not just understanding the medical diagnosis, but identifying specific nursing diagnoses that reflect the patient's actual or potential responses. This also includes anticipating collaborative problems or potential complications. What problems can the nurse directly address through independent nursing interventions, and what requires interdisciplinary collaboration? For example, a medical diagnosis of Addison's disease might lead to nursing diagnoses like fluid volume deficit or maybe risk for injury related to muscle weakness, which you can directly act upon.
Right. Following diagnosis, we engage in planning and goals. This involves establishing clear, measurable, and patient-centered goals based on your nursing diagnoses. These goals provide the direction for your care and are vital for evaluating progress. For a patient with SIADH, a goal might be, patient will maintain euvolemia. It's just a fancy word for normal, balanced fluid volume, as evidenced by stable weight and absence of edema within 48 hours. Something specific like that.
Measurable.
That comes nursing interventions. This is where the doing happens, putting your plan into action. Key interventions in endocrine disorders include continuous, meticulous monitoring for increasing severity of symptoms. Recognizing when a patient is subtly declining or dramatically improving is paramount, as minute changes can herald a crisis. And, crucially, patient education is an ongoing vital intervention. This can range from teaching about medication adherence, recognizing signs of hypo or hyperglycemia, or understanding crucial fluid restrictions. Your teaching can literally prevent readmissions and improve quality of life.
That's huge. Finally, evaluation. This critical step involves assessing whether the nursing interventions have been effective in achieving the patient's goals. Did the patient's fluid balance improve? Did their glucose levels stabilize? If goals haven't been met, you adjust the plan as needed, making the nursing process a continuous, dynamic cycle of care. It's an iterative loop of assessment, planning, intervention, and reevaluation.
That's a powerful framework, yeah. Turning a seemingly abstract system into a concrete set of actions for nurses. All right, let's zoom in on what many call the master gland, the pituitary. This tiny gland, nestled right at the base of the brain, truly packs a huge GE punch, producing and influencing so many hormones throughout the body. Here's where it gets really interesting, because its dysfunction can have these cascading effects that ripple through almost every system.
Indeed, the pituitary, or hypophysis, truly is small but mighty. Its proper function is absolutely critical to overall endocrine health, because it acts as the primary regulator for so many other glands. It's the central command center for much of the body's hormonal orchestration. Let's first consider the anterior pituitary. This part secretes a whole symphony of hormones, each with its specific far-reaching role. We have FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and LH, luteinizing hormone, which are vital for reproductive function and fertility. There's prolactin, essential for milk production after childbirth. ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone, stimulates the adrenal glands to produce cortisol. TSH, thyroid-stimulating hormone, stimulates the thyroid gland to produce thyroid hormones. And of course, GH, growth hormone, which is crucial for growth and metabolism throughout life.
Wow, that's a lot from one small area.
It really is. Now, for the clinical relevance, and this is where your observational skills as a nurse truly shine. When the anterior pituitary is hyperactive, meaning it produces too much of these hormones, we see significant, often visible, conditions. Excess ACTH, for instance, can lead to Cushing syndrome, characterized by specific body changes we'll talk more about later. If excess GH occurs before the growth plates in the bones close during childhood, it results in gigantism, leading to abnormally tall stature. But if that same excess GH occurs after growth plates have closed in adulthood, it causes acromegaly, characterized by enlarged hands, feet, and facial features, but without increased height.
Okay.
Conversely, hypofunction or underproduction of these hormones can lead to conditions like dwarfism in children due to insufficient GH or panhypopituitarism, a severe condition where multiple anterior pituitary hormones are deficient, leading to a widespread decline in various bodily functions, affecting everything from energy levels to fertility. Moving to the posterior pituitary. This section is fundamentally different because it doesn't produce hormones itself. Instead, it acts purely as a storage and release site for two key hormones that are actually produced in the hypothalamus, a neighboring brain region. ADH, antidiuretic hormone, also known as vasopressin, which is crucial for water balance, and oxytocin, famously involved in uterine contractions and milk ejection.
Right, ADH and oxytocin.
Exactly. The clinical relevance here for nursing students is profound, and these are conditions you'll definitely encounter. Hypersecretion of ADH leads to SIADH, syndrome of inappropriate antiandrogenic hormone secretion. This causes the body to retain too much water, often leading to dangerous electrolyte imbalances, particularly low sodium. On the other hand, a hyposecretion of ADH results in DI, diabetes insipidus, where the body loses excessive amounts of water through the kidneys, leading to severe dehydration.
Two very different problems from the same hormone.
Precisely. It's also worth noting that tumors are a common reason for pituitary dysfunction. Thankfully, most of these tumors are benign. When surgery is needed to remove a pituitary tumor or address other issues, it's called a hypophysectomy. For nursing relevance, recognizing the subtle and sometimes profound signs of hyper or hyposecretion of these pituitary hormones is absolutely essential for early identification and intervention. These are often subtle changes in a patient's fluid balance, energy levels, visual fields, or physical appearance that a keen nursing eye can spot and report, potentially preventing a crisis or guiding effective treatment. Your observation skills are literally the first line of defense here.
It's truly fascinating how a gland so small can have such massive systemic effects.
Yeah.
So it seems the two big ones linked to the posterior pituitary diabetes insipidus, or DI, and SIADH, are almost perfect opposites. They're like two sides of the same coin, but facing in completely different directions. So let's really dissect them. Where should we start with DI?
You've hit on the perfect analogy. There are indeed ideal examples of opposing conditions, which makes comparing and contrasting them an excellent way to grasp their distinct mechanisms and crucial management strategies. Understanding their differences will empower you to react appropriately in a crisis. Let's begin with diabetes insipidus, DI, cause. This condition results from an injury to the pituitary gland, which then leads to a deficiency of ADH, or antidiuretic hormone. Without enough ADH, the kidneys are unable to reabsorb water properly from the urine. Think of ADH as the body's water-saving hormone. Without it, the tap is essentially left wide open, constantly flushing fluid.
Okay, so just constant water loss.
Exactly. Clinical manifestations. What stands out here is the truly massive volume of very dilute urine. We're talking about patients who might excrete anywhere from 4 to an astonishing 30 liters of urine per day.
30 liters. Wow.
It's incredible. This leads to profound, unrelenting thirst, polydipsia, excessive fluid intake to try and compensate, and rapid severe signs of dehydration, like dry mucous membranes, decreased skin turgor, a rapid heart rate, and sometimes dangerously low blood pressure, hypotension, due to that fluid volume deficit. They're literally peeing out their body water.
Makes sense.
Diagnostic tests. Key tests include plasma tests, which might show increased osmolality as the blood becomes more concentrated due to water loss, and, critically, urine-specific gravity. You would expect a very low urine-specific gravity, often below 1.005, indicating just how dilute and watery the urine is. Other tests, like a water deprivation test, can also confirm it.
So dilute urine, concentrated blood.
You got it. Management. Medical. The primary approach is to replace the deficient ADH, often using synthetic forms like desmopressin D-ADVP, which can be given orally, intravenously, or intranasally. Nursing. Our focus is critical and multifaceted. Meticulous monitoring for fluid volume deficit is paramount, as rapid dehydration can quickly become life-threatening. You must assess and manage electrolyte imbalances, particularly hypernatremia, high serum sodium, which can be profound due to the disproportionate loss of free water. Continuous vital sign monitoring is essential to track fluid status and early signs of hypovolemic shock. Accurate intake and output measurement is absolutely non-negotiable. You need to track every drop. And thorough patient education on their condition, the critical importance of maintaining adequate fluid intake and especially their medication, like desmopressin, is vital for long-term self-management.
Okay, so DI is about losing too much water. What about SIADH, the opposite?
Exactly. Let's pivot to syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic hormone secretion, SIADH, which, as you correctly noted, is the precise opposite problem, where the body is retaining too much water. Cause. In SIADH, antidiuretic hormone is secreted in excess or inappropriately, often triggered by things like certain cancers, CNS disorders, or specific medications. This causes the patient to retain fluids because the kidneys are reabsorbing too much water. It's like the water tap is barely open or completely shut off, even when the body doesn't need to conserve water, leading to a state of, well, internal drowning, essentially.
So water overload.
Right. clinical manifestations. You'll see concentrated urine, reflecting the kidney's over-retention of water. Patients will experience significant fluid retention, often manifesting as weight gain without visible edema initially, though it can occur. Sometimes you might hear crackles in the lungs from fluid overload. But a critical concern and hallmark of SIADH is hyponatremia, dangerously low serum sodium, which occurs due to the dilutional effects of too much water in the bloodstream. This can lead to severe neurological symptoms as the brain cells swell, making it a true medical emergency.
Low sodium. That sounds serious.
It is very serious. Management. Medical. Treatment involves addressing the underlying cause, if possible, strict fluid restriction, sometimes as low as 500 milliliters a day, to limit further dilution of sodium, and sometimes diuretics, like loop diuretics, to help excrete excess fluid, particularly if sodium levels aren't critically low. Hypertonic saline might be used in severe symptomatic hyponatremia to rapidly increase sodium, but that's done very carefully.
Yeah.
Nursing. This raises an important question. What's the nursing priority here, especially with that fluid retention and low sodium? It's relentless monitoring of intake and output to track fluid balance. You'll be watching for even small changes in weight. Daily weights are crucial, frequent vital signs, and especially meticulous tracking of laboratory values, both urine labs for osmolality and sodium, and a comprehensive metabolic panel, or CMP, which gives you that full picture of electrolytes like sodium and potassium plus kidney function. Crucially, neurological status must be closely monitored due to the severe risk of cerebral edema and seizure activity from profound hyponatremia. Any change in mental status, from subtle confusion to seizures, is an absolute nursing emergency. Immediate reporting, immediate intervention.
Wow, okay.
Patient education, particularly about the strict fluid restrictions, is also vital for both adherence and understanding, and can be really challenging for patients.
I can imagine.
So being able to interpret those clinical changes and laboratory data for both DI and SIADH is paramount for determining the effectiveness of therapy and prioritizing immediate interventions. Recognizing their distinct presentations and potential complications is a core nursing skill that directly impacts patient safety and outcomes. You're the one on the front lines observing these critical fluid and electrolyte shifts.
It's incredibly clear how crucial it is to distinguish between those two. Now let's move from the head down to another pair of vital glands perched atop our kidneys, the adrenals. Most people think adrenaline rush when they hear adrenals, associating them with our fight or flight response. But it seems there's much, much more to them than just that burst of energy. What else are they orchestrating?
You're absolutely right. They're far more complex and integral to systemic function than just stress hormones. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the adrenals are vital for maintaining fluid balance, regulating metabolism, and modulating our immune response, among other things. Each adrenal gland sits atop a kidney and has two main distinct parts, each producing different sets of hormones with different roles. First, there's the adrenal medulla. This is the inner part, and it functions as part of the autonomic nervous system. It's primarily responsible for secreting catecholamines, specifically epinephrine, which you might know as adrenaline, and norepinephrine. These are indeed our classic fight or flight hormones.
Like the stress hormones.
Exactly. Mediating the body's rapid response to stress by increasing heart rate, blood pressure, diverting blood flow to muscles, preparing you to either confront a threat or run from it. Then there's the adrenal cortex. This is the outer layer, and it's critically important because it produces a broader range of steroid hormones that are absolutely essential for life and well-being. These include glucocorticoids. The most prominent example is cortisol. These hormones are involved in glucose metabolism, increasing blood glucose, modulating inflammatory and immune responses, acting as powerful anti-inflammatories, and helping the body respond to stress. They influence nearly every organ system.
So cortisol is key.
Absolutely key. Then there are mineralocorticoids. The primary one here is aldosterone. This hormone is crucial for regulating fluid and electrolyte balance, particularly by promoting sodium reabsorption and potassium excretion in the kidneys. It plays a direct role in maintaining blood pressure and overall fluid volume, making it essential for cardiovascular stability.
Sodium and potassium balance.
Okay. And finally, androgens. These are sex hormones, though produced in much smaller quantities by the adrenals compared to the gonads. They contribute to male sex characteristics and are precursors to estrogens in women. For nursing relevance, understanding these different interconnected roles helps explain the incredibly wide range of symptoms patients can present with when adrenal function is impaired. For instance, problems with glucocorticoids can manifest as issues with blood sugar control or a compromised immune system, making patients susceptible to infection. While mineralocorticoid dysfunction can lead to profound fluid and electrolyte imbalances that quickly become life-threatening, affecting blood pressure and heart rhythm, it's truly a gland with widespread influence.
It's clear that the adrenals are powerhouse glands. And when they go awry, we often hear about two very prominent conditions, Addison's disease and Cushing's syndrome. Just like DI and SIADH, these also seem to be at completely opposite ends of the spectrum, one being a profound deficiency and the other a significant excess. Let's explore that dynamic.
They are indeed contrasting presentations of adrenal dysfunction, making their comparison invaluable for solidifying your understanding. These are high-stakes conditions with widespread systemic effects, and recognizing them quickly is crucial for patient safety. Let's delve into adrenocortical insufficiency, commonly known as Addison's disease. Causes. This condition can be a primary disorder where the adrenal cortex itself is damaged, often due to an autoimmune process. However, a very common cause you'll see in practice is adrenal suppression due to prolonged exogenous steroid use.
So from taking steroid medications.
Exactly. When patients take corticosteroids for extended periods and then stop abruptly, their own adrenal glands, which have been suppressed, don't wake up quickly enough. Essentially, the adrenal cortex isn't producing enough of its vital glucocorticoids and mineralocorticoids.
Ah.
Clinical manifestations. Patients often present with insidious, nonspecific symptoms that worsen over time. Chronic muscle weakness, anorexia, various GI symptoms like nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain. Profound fatigue that isn't relieved by rest is a hallmark. A classic and striking sign, particularly in primary Addison's, is generalized dark pigmentation of the skin and mucosa, especially in creases or scars, almost like a permanent tan.
A tan.
Yeah. Hypotension is common due to decreased aldosterone leading to sodium and water loss. Lab values typically show low blood glucose, hypoglycemia, low serum sodium, hyponatremia, and high serum potassium, hyperkalemia, a dangerous triad. Patients may also exhibit neuropsychiatric symptoms like apathy, emotional ability, and confusion.
Low sugar, low sodium, high potassium.
You got it. Acute complication. Addisonian crisis. Adrenal crisis. This is a life-threatening emergency. It's characterized by severe, sudden symptoms, most notably profound hypotension that can lead to vascular collapse and shock, often triggered by stress, infection, or abrupt discontinuation of corticosteroids. It requires immediate medical intervention or the patient can quickly die.
A true emergency.
Absolutely. Diagnostic tests. Diagnosis is made through measuring adrenocortical hormone levels like cortisol in the morning, ACTH levels, and crucially the ACTH stimulation test, which assesses the adrenal gland's ability to respond. Management. Medical. For acute adrenal insufficiency or crisis, immediate intravenous fluids, often saline with dextrose, are crucial to address dehydration and hypoglycemia. High doses of intravenous corticosteroids, like hydrocortisone, are vital. Corticosteroid doses must be adjusted for stress. Patients need significantly higher doses during illness or surgery. Vasopressors may be needed for severe hypotension, and antibiotics if infection is a trigger.
Fluids and steroids, fast.
Fast. Nursing. Prioritizing nursing care involves vigilant monitoring of vital signs every 15-30 minutes for signs of shock. You must meticulously assess for fluid volume deficit and manage IV access. Monitoring skin changes, maintaining accurate fluid balance, INO, and promoting increased activity tolerance as the patient stabilizes are also key. Crucially, patient education, especially regarding medication adherence, taking corticosteroids for life, and stress dosing, how to increase their medication during stress, is paramount to prevent future crises. This teaching is a life-saving intervention.
Stress dosing, that's critical. Okay, so that's Addison's, not enough hormones. What about Cushing's? Too much.
Exactly. Let's turn to Cushing's syndrome, the polar opposite, where the body is awash in excess cortisol. Causes. This results from excessive adrenocortical activity. The most common cause in clinical practice is prolonged corticosteroid medication use, iatrogenic Cushing's. But it can also be due to an adrenal tumor, a pituitary tumor secreting too much ACTH, or an ectopic ACTH-producing tumor elsewhere. Signs and symptoms. Cushing's presents with a striking and often distressing constellation of symptoms. Patients commonly experience hyperglycemia due to excess cortisol, often leading to new onset or worsened diabetes. A characteristic central type obesity develops with a notable buffalo hump, a fat pad between the shoulders, heavy trunk, and surprisingly thin extremities due to muscle wasting.
The buffalo hump and moon face.
Those are the classic descriptions, yeah. A round red moon face appearance is common. Skin changes are prominent. Fragile, thin skin that bruises easily, ecchymosis. Minor bumps become major bleeds and purple or red striae. stretch marks on the abdomen, thighs, breasts. Patients often report generalized weakness, lassitude, sleep disturbances. Osteoporosis leading to increased fracture risk and muscle wasting are significant concerns. Hypertension is common, as are acne, increased susceptibility to infection, and slow wound healing.
Wow, it affects so many systems.
It really does. In women, virilization, masculine physical traits like hirsutism and loss of libido may occur. Mood changes, irritability, anxiety, depression are also frequent. Lab values typically show increased serum sodium and decreased serum potassium, the opposite of Addison's.
High sodium, low potassium. Okay.
Diagnostic test. The dexamethasone suppression test helps confirm the diagnosis by assessing the body's response to an exogenous corticosteroid. Cortisol levels fail to suppress as they should in Cushing's. Management, medical. Treatment might involve surgery to remove a tumor, or very commonly, gradually decreasing the dose of corticosteroids if the cause is external. This must be done slowly to avoid precipitating an Addisonian crisis.
I can't stop steroids suddenly.
Absolutely not. Treating associated conditions like diabetes and hypertension is also essential. Nursing interventions. This requires a multifaceted nursing approach. Maintaining adequate cardiac output due to potential hypertension, decreasing risk of injury due to fragile skin and osteoporosis, even basic care requires extreme gentleness. Preventing infection is paramount as excess cortisol suppresses the immune system. Promoting skin integrity, helping patients cope with the significant body image changes, which can be very distressing. Monitoring and managing potential complications, including Addisonian crisis if steroids are withdrawn too quickly. And patient education is vital for long-term management, including gradual steroid tapering.
Lots of nursing considerations there.
Huge. For nursing relevance, being able to differentiate between these two, the lack in Addison's versus the excess in Cushing's, interpret the labs, and understand the core nursing priorities is critical for protecting patients, managing fluids and electrolytes, and providing that holistic care.
That comparison is incredibly insightful. Okay, finally, let's turn our attention to two critical diabetic emergencies, diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA, and hyperglycemic hyperosmolar syndrome, HHS. These are acute, life-threatening conditions that demand immediate and precise nursing action. The notes also give us a case study, so let's tie that in and really apply these concepts.
Absolutely. These are absolute nursing priorities due to their high acuity and significant potential for mortality. Understanding their distinct pathophysiology and management is crucial for every nurse. Your actions in the first hour can truly determine survival. Let's start with diabetic ketoacidosis, DKA. Cause. DKA arises from an absolute absence or inadequate amount of insulin. When insulin is critically low, the body can't use glucose for energy, even if there's lots of glucose in the blood. This forces the body to break down fat for energy, producing acidic byproducts called ketones. This leads to metabolic acidosis. DKA often occurs in type 1 diabetics, frequently triggered by infection or missed insulin doses.
No insulin, so fat breakdown leading to ketones and acid.
You got it. Clinical features. The hallmarks are severe hyperglycemia, significant dehydration from osmotic diuresis, and profound metabolic acidosis due to ketones. Patients often present with nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and maybe a fruity breath odor from ketones. Assessment of DKA. Blood glucose levels are typically high, often 250 to 800 mg/dL. But remember, the severity isn't just about the glucose level. Acidosis and dehydration matter just as much. Ketoacidosis is reflected in low serum bicarbonate and low pH. You'll see a low PCO2, reflecting compensatory small respirations, that deep, rapid breathing trying to blow off CO2.
Small breathing, right?
Yes. Ketones will be in blood and urine. Electrolytes vary. Potassium might initially seem normal or high due to shifts, but total body potassium is often depleted. You'll also see increased creatinine, HTT, and BUN from dehydration. Management of DKA. Key interventions. Rehydration with IV fluid is the absolute first priority, critical to restore volume and perfusion. This is followed by a continuous IV infusion of regular insulin to reverse acidosis and lower glucose.
Fluids first, then insulin.
Often, yes, or concurrently, depending on the protocol and patient status. Critical note on electrolytes. This is a major nursing alert. Rehydration dilutes potassium, and insulin drives potassium into cells. This means potassium levels need very close, vigilant monitoring, oxygen hourly, and potassium replacement is frequently required, sometimes even if initial levels look okay, to prevent life-threatening hypokalemia and cardiac arrhythmias. You have to anticipate this drop.
Okay, watch that potassium like a hawk.
Absolutely. Monitoring. Nurses must vigilantly monitor blood glucose hourly, renal function output, ECGs for arrhythmia risk, all electrolytes, vital signs, and lung assessments for fluid overload during rehydration.
Okay, that's DKA. How is HHS different?
Good question. Let's differentiate it from hyperglycemic hyperosmolar syndrome, HHS. Cause. HHS is also caused by a lack of sufficient insulin, but unlike DKA, there is usually some insulin present. This small amount is often enough to prevent massive fat breakdown and ketone production. So ketosis is minimal or absent. HHS is more common in type 2 diabetics, often triggered by infection or illness.
Some insulin, so no ketones, but still problems.
Big problems. Physiology. The primary issue here is extreme hyperglycemia, often much higher than DKA, frequently over 600 mgDL, sometimes even over 1,000. This leads to profound osmotic diuresis, resulting in significant loss of water and electrolytes, severe hypernatremia, and drastically increased serum osmolality. The blood gets super concentrated. Patients can be far more profoundly dehydrated than in DKA.
Even more dehydrated than DKA?
Well. Often, yes. Up to 25% fluid loss. Manifestations. Patients present with severe hypotension due to extreme dehydration, profound dehydration itself, tachycardia, and often very prominent and variable neurologic signs caused by cerebral dehydration, confusion, lethargy, seizures, coma. The severe dehydration of brain cells causes these neurochanges.
Neurological signs are key in HHS then?
Very key, and often more pronounced than in DKA. Mortality. It carries a high mortality rate, often higher than DKA, precisely because of the extreme dehydration and the severe neurological impact. Management of HHS. Similar to DKA, aggressive rehydration with IV fluids is the cornerstone, often needing many liters. This is followed by insulin administration, usually continuous IV. Close monitoring of fluid volume and electrolytes is paramount. Prevention. This really highlights the importance of timely diagnosis and management of diabetes and promoting self-care skills, especially sick day rules, to prevent these crises.
Okay, DKA versus HHS. Acidosis in DKA, more neuro changes and dehydration in HHS. Got it. Now let's put this into action. Let's look at Jerry Thomas, our 26-year-old type 1 diabetic soccer coach with a two-day history of vomiting and diarrhea. He's been trying to manage with insulin and liquids, but now can't even tolerate Gatorade. His provider suspects DKA. His initial BG is 425, serum sodium 152, and serum potassium 3.0. How would you as a nurse begin to unravel this?
Okay, Jerry's case is a perfect example. What's fascinating here is how his symptoms and labs align with our discussion and immediately flag nursing priorities. His two-day history of vomiting and diarrhea immediately screams dehydration. He's losing massive amounts of fluid and electrolytes, and now he can't even keep Gatorade down. That alone explains why he feels so awful.
Right. The fluid loss is huge.
Huge. His blood glucose of 425 mgDL is consistent with DKA hyperglycemia. But remember, it's not just the glucose level. We need to think about acidosis and hydration, too. Now, let's look at his electrolytes. These are screaming for attention. His serum sodium of 152 mUQL points to significant hypernatremia. In DKA, despite the osmotic diuresis, the loss of free water often exceeds sodium loss, leading to this concentrated state. This hypernatremia contributes to the increased osmolality affecting neural function.
Okay, high sodium due to water loss.
Exactly. And his serum potassium of 3.0 mEQL is low. This is very common and dangerous in DKA due to renal losses, intracellular shifts, and overall depletion. This low potassium is a critical concern because correcting acidosis and giving insulin will drive potassium further into cells, potentially causing severe, life-threatening hypokalemia and cardiac arrhythmias.
So that low potassium is a major red flag even before treatment starts.
Major red flag. So this scenario for Jerry unequivocally underscores the immediate need for aggressive rehydration with IV fluids and a continuous IV insulin infusion. But the crucial aha moment for you as a nurse here is that low potassium, you need vigilant electrolyte monitoring, especially potassium, and anticipating the need for prompt replacement before or concurrently with insulin to prevent a cardiac arrest.
Okay, so how would you prioritize interventions for Jerry right now?
For Jerry, the immediate nursing priorities would be 1, fluid resuscitation. Get those IV fluids running rapidly as prescribed to correct the severe dehydration and improve perfusion. Refill the tank. 2, electrolyte management, especially potassium. Monitor his potassium, sodium, and other electrolytes closely. Given his low initial potassium, anticipate and initiate potassium replacement early, often before or concurrently with insulin to prevent that dangerous drop.
Replace potassium early. Got it.
3, insulin administration. Initiate the continuous IV regular insulin infusion as ordered. This will slowly lower blood glucose, stop ketone production, and reverse acidosis. Slow and steady on the glucose drop. 4, continuous monitoring, hourly blood glucose checks, frequent vital signs, especially BP and heart rate, strict INO, and close neurological assessments for any changes.
Fluids, potassium, insulin, monitor everything.
That's the core approach. For nursing relevance, being able to compare and contrast DKA and HHS is absolutely crucial. Recognizing the differences in presentation, prioritizing those immediate life-saving interventions, rehydration, insulin, electrolytes, and understanding the critical role of monitoring and patient education is key. Prioritizing care for patients with poor glucose regulation is a constant challenge demanding precision, vigilance, and critical interpretation of data.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, from the master conductor pituitary gland to the stress-responding adrenals, and then tackled those urgent crises of DKA and HHS. It truly highlights the interconnectedness of our body's systems and the critical vigilant role nursing plays in managing its disorders. So what does this all mean for you embarking on a nursing career? We've explored these tiny glands and their monumental impacts. What are the biggest takeaways, the core principles to carry forward?
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture of your crucial role as a nurse, these are indeed the core principles and objectives to carry forward into your practice. They really distill the essence of effective endocrine nursing care. First and foremost, it's about protection and safety. Protecting patients with pituitary or adrenal problems from injury, falls from weakness, skin tears from fragility, and from problems associated with those rapid fluid and electrolyte shifts, it's paramount. Constant vigilance.
Safety first.
Always. Second, patient education is empowerment. Identifying teaching priorities for patients on hormone replacement isn't just a task, it's a cornerstone of empowering self-management. Medication schedules, adherence, signs of too much or too little hormone, and critically, stress dosing. Your teaching enables them to live full lives.
Empowering the patient.
Exactly. Third, consider holistic care. Reducing the psychological impact for the patient and family is vital. Body image changes, energy levels, mood swings, these are profound.
Yeah.
Providing emotional support and resources is essential. Care for the whole person.
Right, the psychosocial aspect.
Absolutely. Fourth, developing clinical acumen. Your ability to accurately interpret subtle clinical changes and lab data for conditions like DI and SIADH is a direct measure of your developing expertise. Seeing patterns, connecting dots, anticipating needs, it's a skill you hone constantly.
Thinking like a nurse.
Precisely. Fifth, prioritization in crisis. Prioritizing nursing care in acute adrenal insufficiency, DKA, or HHS, is where critical thinking truly shines. Rapid, decisive, correct action means the difference between life and death. You are that immediate lifeline.
Making those critical decisions.
Sixth, coordination is key. Coordinating care for complex patients across multiple conditions requires synthesis, teamwork with the interdisciplinary team, and understanding how these conditions interact. You are often the hub of their care.
The coordinate.
And finally, critical differentiation. The ability to accurately compare and contrast labs and interventions for DKA and HHS will literally save lives. Recognizing those subtle but crucial distinctions dictates your immediate actions. This isn't just about memorizing facts for an exam. It's about developing that sharp clinical judgment to see the entire patient picture, anticipate complications, and intervene effectively. The endocrine system is a powerful reminder that small imbalances have monumental consequences, and your role as a nurse is central to restoring balance and promoting well-being. It's challenging but incredibly rewarding.
And that wraps up another deep dive into the complex yet incredibly rewarding world of endocrine nursing. We've journeyed through the body's delicate orchestration, exploring what happens when that balance shifts, and hopefully equipping you with the critical insights needed to manage these conditions effectively. So as you step into your clinical rotations or sit down for your exams, remember that behind every lab value, every subtle patient symptom in endocrine disorders, there's a story of delicate balance hanging in the air. Your informed, observant, and compassionate care can be the most powerful intervention of all. How will you use this knowledge to become the advocate and healer your patients need? We'll see you next time for another deep dive.